we're going to close the show tonight with the story about Roger Lear. Roger he passed away on Friday, and we know him basically because of implants, but he's done other things too in the UFO field, but he's been involved in a long time. And the memorial service for Roger will be Wednesday, and it's March 19th at it will be in Mission Hills, California, and the memorial service definitely will be held then, and that's on Wednesday, and it'll be held at the Eden Memorial Park, and that's in Mission Hills, California, as I said. Roger Lear has been a very interesting person all along. One thing, I don't have the details really nailed down, even though I notice on some of the social media and some other places, there's several versions of how he died. I do know that Roger had two accidents, and we'll talk about those in a minute. The latest, or the most current accident, he rolled over his car. And he was in serious shape for a long time. I think that happened in 2010. And so, you know, Roger has been battling. He never really fully recovered, in my opinion, on that automobile accident. And he had another accident as well that I want to talk about. In fact, I tell you what, we did an interview with Roger Lear back in 2008 in Laughlin, California, Laughlin, Nevada. And at the, I believe we were at the Flamingo at that time, I think is what it was called. And anyway, Roger sat down with the shows I was doing direct from there, broadcasting from a major UFO conference. And Roger told me about something I didn't know about him. And that was that he hadn't had a plane crash and was able to walk away from it. So now if you stop and think about it, Dr. Lear had a plane crash. Then a few years later, he rolled his car over and was injured severely. And I think the story I hear, and I'm not sure if we can really nail this down, maybe somebody knows the facts and they can email me at jerry@jerrypippin.com and tell me. As far as I know, Roger Friday was either in the hospital or at his doctor's office, and he got up to go to the bathroom, and he never came back out. They went in and opened the door, and there he was, dead. Let's go ahead and play this interview where Roger's talking about first his aircraft crash, and then after that we're going to talk a little bit about implants and a very interesting discussion. So we'll close the show out with that.
We're at the Aquarius Resort Casino Hotel on the beautiful Colorado River, and they deal in numbers at casinos, and numbers are important in the universe. As we just went to the break, we were talking about everything has to have a positive or negative reaction, and of course, the if you're going to have order, you have to have chaos, you have to compare, if nothing else. Right, Dr. Lear?
That's absolutely correct.
You're a recognized physician, a man of medicine, a man of science. How did you get interested in this subject?
Well, I've really been interested in this subject since I was yay high to a grasshopper, because that year, that very, very famous year, 1947, I remember my father specifically bringing the San Francisco Examiner into our kitchen and laying it on a table and reading the headline of my mother, U.S. Army Air Force captures flying saucer. And he went into a long dissertation about, see, honey, I always told you, we aren't the only intelligent entities in the vastness of this universe. And I stood there, and I was really impressed. Well, my father was sort of a straightforward, you know, kind of an old-fashioned guy. And if you said you were the U.S. Army Air Force, then, like, a plumber or electrician or a carpenter, that was your field. So in his view, you better know everything there is to know. If you're a plumber, then you better know everything about putting pipes together and which way fluids run.
Right.
And if you're an electrician, then you better know how to put the wires together so that, you know. So when the next headline came out and said not a saucer but a balloon, I mean, he was absolutely incredulous. And he said, do you mean to tell me that the United States Army Air Force can't tell the difference between a saucer and a balloon? So, you know, when you hear something like that and you're a kid and, you know, you go through the kind of life that that I had. I really wanted to be an astronomer, but never had good enough grades in math, which were required for astronomy. So I went in the next best thing, which was, and finally, into podiatric medicine. But I've always been interested in the sky, you know. And again, as a child, I had those childhood fantasies of wanting to fly. My grandfather was a tailor, and one of the sweetest things he ever did for me was he made me a tailored Superman cape.
Wow.
And we lived on a big hill, you know, so I used to put on my cape, you know, with the other kids, and he'd go flying down this hill. Of course, you were running.
Right.
You know. Always wanted to fly.
I would like, always pretended I had a Superman suit on. You had a real one.
I had a real Superman.
Yeah, I mean, I had a towel and a T-shirt.
Right. Well, that's what I had before my grandfather made this. But then later when I got out of school, and when you get out of school, you don't have any money. So I used to clip out these little coupons from the newspaper where these fixed base operators would give away a free flying lesson. So I would go down to one place and I'd say, yeah, I'd like to learn to fly. And then I would go up and I'd get a free lesson. And then I would wait for another one to come out with a free coupon. And I go to another FBO and he says, you sure you never been in a plane before? You never flown? No, no, this is my first time, honest, sir. Well, I said, you seem to be a natural for this. And I wasn't. But then I.
But you've been through it.
So then I did this, you know, about 10 to 15 times in a year, finding these different little airports.
Well, up in the San Francisco area, there's a lot of airports.
Oh, yeah. Well, there was. There was down in Southern California.
Okay, down there. Yeah, right.
So that's the way I did it. And then finally, I was able to get enough money to actually pay for a few lessons.
Do you fly anymore?
I haven't flown in some years, but, you know, when you fly, you always want to do something better and better and bigger plane.
It's an expensive hobby.
Yeah, more of this and more of that, carry more weight, carry more passengers. So I got out, I checked out in the whole single-engine Cessna line, and then I got checked out in the Piper line, and I said, you know, I got to get a multi-engine rating. So I went down and I found a wonderful deal on a Piper Apache 160. It was a twin, and the plane was so old, each rudder pedal was like pushing a barn door. I had to do setups to just move the rudder pedals. But I got my multi-engine rating in that, and then I put some hours in an Aero Commander 500 and a number of different other aircraft.
You ever see anything while you're up there?
No, I saw a lot of sky and a lot of beautiful things.
But no UFOs.
Never saw a UFO. But I did have an aircraft accident, which I've talked about in both editions of The Aliens and the Scalpel, the two books that I had written by that title, where I did have an accident flying a Blanca 500 in 1973. And it took me 17 years to find the cause of that accident. And I blamed everybody from the mechanics to the FBO that I rented it from, to the attorneys, to the FAA. And I found out after 17 years that I was in the wrong place at the wrong time, because China Lake Naval Air Station was experimenting with pulse beam weaponry.
And you got one.
I got one. I was the victim of it.
But you lived through it.
Yeah, I had no idea that even China Lake was...
China Lake's where a lot of the action probably was happening in there all the time.
It was, but I didn't know anything about an underground base. I was a young guy, enjoyed flying, and this is in the wrong place.
What was that experience like? Was there anything that you just...
Well, we started, it was a little dinner flight, which I had done many times before, carrying my wife and a couple of passengers, and we were flying from Van Nuys, California, to Bakersfield, and one of the things you do when you fly is you always go someplace to eat.
I've noticed that.
You eat, you fly back. So nothing extraordinary about the flight, except we were about 10,000 feet, and there was no moon, and... suddenly, we began to lose things, to make a long story short. Losing part of the radio and losing the transponder and losing all the navigational instruments. But we lost a series of instruments which were not interconnected. And all you could hear was this popping sound coming over the radio. And then, we could not see the lights of Bakersfield, which was very unusual. So I chose to go to an alternate airport, which was Inyokern out in the desert, which is just a little bit south of China Lake Naval Air Station. And then we began to lose everything else on the panel, started to go. So I said, we got to get this thing on the ground. So I figured, mentally, if we go, I'm not going to take anybody in the town with us. We'll go to China Lake. And so we flew to China Lake, going right into the spider's den, and they gave me a red light, which means don't land. So absolutely incredulous. This just doesn't happen. Finally, they came back with a green light, and I put it down about 500 feet from the threshold of the runway. It was so dark in the desert that the crash crew couldn't find us. So we finally had to signal, and they came out and brought us onto the base and ambulances and took us into a dispensary where every single piece of equipment was covered with a sheet like it hadn't been used in years. But here's a whole big active base. Why wasn't the dispensary being used? But when you're injured and you're in an accident and you got other people, you don't really think of those things. You just say, oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
They sure keep things clean.
Everything's
all covered up.
That's the Navy for you.
They could barely find the light switches to turn things on. And once they got us cleaned up, they didn't waste any time getting us out of there. They took us in a military ambulance to Inyokern General Hospital. And then the next day, the base commander came out and talked to me and asked my permission, to release the wreck to the FAA. And I thought, even at that time, being a young, inexperienced person, why would they need my... I mean, it's one federal agency to another. Why would they need my permission? So I just signed the document. But they brought us all the little pieces that we had laying around in the desert, like my watch. They brought us my hands and the face
of the watch.
Of the watch and pieces of a plastic comb, in little bags of sand. They combed that entire area where that plane crashed out there.
You think they were seeing if there was any evidence of this particle beam weapon or whatever it was?
That's exactly what they were doing. Uh-huh. And then when I was so stupid and I released the plane... I don't know where it went before it went back to the FAA and the FBO. But when I got out of the hospital and I got back to the base, to the fixed base operator in Van Nuys, guess what was missing out of the aircraft? The entire panel was gone.
One that had the things shutting down.
That's right. And I said, well, where's the panel? oh, well, it's out being investigated. Nobody, and this went through a long court session, which lasted for years, but we never found the panel to the plane. Nobody knew where it went.
Incredible story. Everybody survived, though, in that crash?
No, I didn't.
Oh, okay. Other than you. Now we understand.
No, I did have a near-death experience with that crash. That was my second one.
From the crash?
From the crash, yeah.
And you've had two?
I've had two.
Was the other one when you were younger? Or
the other one was I was a little bit younger, and I was...
I had a comedy partner when I was doing stand-up comedy in the 80s. He had a near-death experience. He liked to talk about it, but he didn't at the same time.
Well, I was the victim of a practical joke in that one, and but I did. I went through the whole deal, the tunnel of light, and heard the voice, and it was a very kind voice. But when that happens to you, you really can't describe it in human semantics. The peace that you feel, you really don't want to go back. You know,
yeah.
But the voice tells you it's not your time and you have to go back. But at the aircraft accident, I was there again, you know, going through
the same thing.
And it was the same voice.
Same voice.
However, this time, the voice was very irritated. And it's like, don't you get it, you bloody idiot? You were told before, it's not your time. Very scolding in character.
Amazing.
Go back.
Irritated.
Yeah, very, very irritated. Like, don't you get it? You know, hey, stupid, you're not supposed to be here. Go back. And then, you know, I was slammed back in my body again, and the first thing that happened was I thought I was blind. And fortunately, I wasn't, because the blood had come out of my forehead and it was running down my eyes. So I wiped my eyes and I realized
and
that
you
I could
see. Right.
But so anyway, what I said is a joke about being dead was only partially a joke.
But well, it's maybe a joke, but you were pretty close to it.
Yeah, yeah, at least
twice.
Probably for a moment. There was a recent case.
I don't want to say third time's a charm to you.
They talked about it on Bill O'Reilly. There was a case where a guy was dead for 90 minutes.
Wow.
90 minutes in a body bag. You know, in the hospital morgue, and the guy comes back and he tells the whole story about where he's been. You know, and Bill O'Reilly is about the strangest show where you could ever hear something like that.
Yeah, that's amazing. So he actually wasn't there just for a few minutes like you were, or seconds or whatever. I wonder what happened in 90 minutes.
Yeah, I didn't hear the whole story, but I know that he is either writing or has written a book.
Yeah.
And I'm going to try and get a copy.
What kind of experience? You're a medical doctor. You've been involved in all of this all your life, life and death as part of this business. What do you draw from all this? This near-death experience. Your story is not different from others. They all say the same thing.
That's right.
You got to go back.
Yeah.
I don't want to.
Right.
Yeah.
You don't want to. And, you know, maybe when you do go, if it's the same experience, it's not...
they say, okay, you can stay.
Yeah, you can stay. It's your time. Come along. And, you know, people talk about seeing relatives and having their life go before them, especially in drowning experiences. But there are experts in that field. I'm not. My cousin is one, the very famous Ken Ring, who has written a number of books on near-death experiences. And I told him the story, and he says, yours is just, one of many.
Roger Lear is our guest. We're going to take a break and come back. I'm going to find out about the implants a little bit more. And find out what he talked about here at Laughlin and what's on his plate. I'm sure it'll be a busy and full plate. I'm Jerry Pippin. Don't go away. Dr. Roger Lear is our guest. I'm Jerry Pippin. We are at the UFO Congress, and, of course, that's in Laughlin, Nevada, at the Aquarius Resort. We kind of brushed over the implant story, Dr. Lear, as far as your most recent ones. You've had some... You haven't given up. In other words, you do this quite often. And how long have you been doing implant surgery?
Well, the first surgeries we did were in 1995. Now we've done 14 cases, and as the time goes on and we're able to amass more data, we're able to make comparisons between the data from the past and the current data and kind of make new conclusions and draw things together. So now we have some numbers we can go by, and we can say, you know, statistically we have so many that are little metallic rods. We have so many that emanate from 4 to 10 milligauss of electromagnetic strength before they're removed. We have so many that show a biological coating. We have so many that that you can look at with an electron microscope. And the last one, we knew for some time that this layer, this outer layer of biological tissue is apparently growing into the metal. But now this is the first time in this last case. You know, and also, Jerry, the equipment gets better because the
yeah, I hadn't thought about that, but you're right.
Yeah, the SEMs, the scanning electron microscopes, get more expensive, and they get better, and you're able to do more things. Now we actually have a piece of metal with biological tissue growing out of it.
It's literally coming out of the metal.
It's growing out of the metal. And when the we had a couple of experts there from MIT, and when they saw that, they called me on the phone because I wasn't in the lab. I was in the office. And I said, we've got the strangest anomaly that they have ever seen here. It's just virtually impossible to make biological tissue grow out of metal and they're blown away. Of course, when you watch the program in its final cut, you know, after 8 days of shooting, you're shooting, maybe 10, 12 hours a day, and you wind up with about 37 minutes of programming, and then the editor sits down and cuts it to whatever he wants to cut it, you wind up with an entertainment program. You don't wind up with any kind of a documentary. So, but I'm telling you things that we're not.
How does the scientific community take to this implant?
I addressed that in my presentation yesterday. It's very, very difficult to find what's called academic honesty. Because everybody's got, even in science, there's something held over their head or there's some axe to grind. So what they can tell you privately or even in front of a camera, they can't come out in the public and actually talk about it. It just doesn't happen. Now, Dr. Doug Perovich, who is the head of the material science department at the University of Toronto, which is one of the finest material science laboratories in the world. It's the laboratory that NASA sent the material to from the Columbia disaster, because Congress passed a law that NASA couldn't do their own analysis of the metal.
Mm-hmm.
So here's a very trusty individual who's extremely well qualified, and all through the procedure, I spent days there with this man in the lab with an infinite amount of equipment, modern equipment that's worth millions and millions of dollars. I mean, and he was fascinated by what he saw, and I showed a few clips of some of the comments. One was, Dr. Lear, couldn't you have brought me something easier?
Yeah.
Well, here's a world-renowned metallurgist who's saying to me, couldn't you brought me something easier? And then seeing things through these various pieces of analytical equipment, and you ask him, what is it? And he says, I don't know, but we're going to try and find out. And then you watch the program, and here he is at the end of the program, coming on in a scene that was never shot while I was there. It was shot 3 weeks after I had left.
They came back to do a pickup shot.
Back to do a pickup with him holding a hunting knife, and he says, this is probably a piece of a hunting knife.
How do you think that happened?
Well, I think it simply happened because they're not going to have the guy who was responsible for the bilge that they put about the Columbia disaster being caused by a piece of tile coming off. That guy in authority, they're not going to have him coming out and talk about alien implants and that there's something unusual
in this
material.
So you suspect it was at the university level in regard to funding?
Oh, it's whoever funds the university and who's ever responsible for getting the contractual work from the United States to do that. They work in conjunction with each other.
I wonder why the network or the producer or the company, the production company, went along with it.
Because, like I originally said, they're in the entertainment business. And it's all entertainment. They couldn't give a hoot as to what the content is. But, you know, you say, well, why do I do it then? I mean, you don't get the truth.
Going to ask you that, but why do you do it?
Well, because I get the data. I get reams and reams and reams of expensive data.
And they can't censor you.
They can't censor me. All I can do is talk to a few people.
Have you ever been censored?
No.
Okay, good.
No.
I haven't either.
I've had problems with the state, but never with the federal government.
State of California.
But I have I've had indications that the federal government knows exactly who I am. One was a telephone conversation I had with Edgar Mitchell.
Oh, really?
Who I don't know from Adam.
But he called you.
I called him,
okay,
and he returned my call, and he was on a cell phone in Florida, and my secretary said he was on the phone, and I picked up the phone, and I said, "Hi, Dr. Mitchell, this is Dr. Lear in California. I don't suppose you know who I am," and he's a very matter-of-fact guy, cuts me off in mid-sentence and said, "But Dr. Lear, we all know who you are." So, I mean, here's an astronaut telling me that he knows who I am. So I suppose if an astronaut knows who I am, the rest of them know who I am, too. So as long as you don't, it's okay to row, but don't rock the boat.
That's a good way to close the show. Another word of wisdom from Dr. Roger Lear. Is it something we can plug? What's happening here in your life?
Well, we've gotten our movie still on the drawing boards. We've done several teasers for the film. We still need some more funds to keep that going. We now have a full budget.
I think they're lining up ready to donate to you. So it'd be a good investment. It wouldn't be a donation.
No, it wouldn't, because I think that the film would really be a moneymaker if it was done right.
What you're doing. Sounds fantastic.
Yeah, it's not a documentary. Documentaries don't make any money, but this is a full-fledged entertainment film. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the research is going on, ANS research. I'm continuing to do more television events, and try and raise money where we can, because that's the only way we can continue the research. People are kind enough to donate a little bit here and a little bit there. That's just one more test we can do, or another piece of equipment that we can buy.
Our final question with Dr. Lear: what do you make of those implants? Is that a tracking device or what?
No, Jerry, I don't think they're tracking devices, because I think that any intelligence that's on a higher level than us-ins doesn't need a tracking device, especially when we know that our DNA has its own electronic signature. So if we were capable of building a device that would detect your electronic signature or anybody else, you just dial
it,
we could find you anywhere you wanted to find. Mm-hmm. But I do think they're devices for getting information out of the individual who they've done something to, and since most of the abduction scenario involves the taking of ova and sperm, you have to realize there's something that's genetic that's going on. If you listen to Dr. David Jacobs, who's a well-known authority, he thinks they're building a hybrid race, and perhaps they are, but I also think that it may not be one agenda, and I think one of the possibilities is that they are actually changing human DNA, because the kids born within the last 50, 60 years are not the same human beings, certainly, as I am.
Really?
Yeah, they have capabilities and abilities
we're better.
That we don't have.
The new kids are better.
The new kids are better.
Physically, at least.
They're better physically, and they're better mentally, psychologically, because they have knowledge that they don't have to get out of a book or watch on television.
You're talking about it's already there.
It's already there. It's a changing of the human race. Now, maybe they are building hybrids. You know, maybe if the problem isn't solved by changing humanity, maybe if the problem isn't solved that way, maybe there's an alternative. Maybe there's a hybrid race that can come if we destroy ourselves.
A backup.
Yeah, maybe there's a backup. So the agenda may not be all one and the same, but I really think that...
The clock has got us, Dr. Roger Lear. I always enjoy it. Thanks very much.
Okay, Jerry,
thanks,
my pleasure.
Shanina Johnson is our on-location producer, and, of course, Jane Swartley up in Boulder is doing the final production editing. And, Roger, you can take it up with her if the show's not on by tomorrow, okay?
Okay, I will, Jerry.
Okay, until
right
next time, this is Jerry Pippin. Cheers.